Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. Look, I know this is the time when you want to bust out your most wow-em dessert recipes, but what about for those of us who don't really have one of those? Well, check out this episode from last year about secretly simple desserts. Have fun. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So, I am probably violating my own HIPAA privacy rights right now, but I'll tell you the story anyway. Because I was at the doctor the other day, just for a physical, and she asked me at the beginning if I was fasting, because she wanted to draw blood for some tests, and I go, I don't know, how many hours was I supposed to not be eating? Because, you know, I had a little ice cream last night at 8:30. And without batting an eyelash, she goes, well, you know, you could skip the ice cream. Honestly, I felt so personally attacked. Like, okay, judgy. So this episode is for Dr. Jules, because it's all about awesome sweets that are secretly simple, which means it's going to be that much easier to get to dessert, okay? We have pastry chef Paula Velez on her favorite ways to make a simple custard extra special, baker Aran Goyoaga on a 6-ingredient cookie that goes back centuries, one of my favorite chefs in the world, Dave Barron, on the burnt Basque cheesecake that's launched 1,000 imitators, and first, a pioneer in shortcut baking, Anne Byrne. Over 20 years ago, Anne wrote The Cake Mix Doctor, a mega-selling cookbook that hacked box mixes to make great cakes. And now she's back with a new take on cake. Hey, Anne. It's great to talk with you.
You as well, Francis.
You know, just the other day, I was talking with Dori Greenspan, who, you know, is one of the great bakers in America. And we both just kind of like confessed to each other, you know, if I'm making a pumpkin pie, I'm just going to open a can of pumpkin pie filling.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I am definitely not one to turn my nose up at a shortcut at home, but cake mix is like a little controversial.
Yeah.
So, let's go back. Like, your first book was The Cake Mix Doctor 20 years ago. What gave you the idea to write that book?
Well, I was living the life, Francis. You know, I was a young mom, relatively young. I had 3 young children for sure. And, you know, my life was crazy frantic. And you know, we had moved back to Nashville and, you know, I had been in Atlanta, you know, with the newspaper there writing about gourmet cooking and all the restaurants. And moving back to Nashville, it was definitely a wake-up call and realized that people still baked with cake mixes. And not only baked, but they really baked well with them. And so all of a sudden, cake mixes, I mean, the idea of using a mix kind of creeped into, you know, the way I cooked. And I saw it as a shortcut because I could bake at night when my kids were asleep.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously it offers a lot in terms of convenience, but you told me that it felt, you know, when you wrote this book, you know, there were people who loved it and they were super excited about it. And there were people who, I think you said the word you used was divisive.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is funny because I came from the world of newspapers where I was taught and raised to, you know, to write what the reader wanted and to put recipes out there and all different types of recipes and see what kind of gravitates with people. And cake mixes did. And cakes that started with a mix were one of the most popular recipes we had at the Atlanta newspapers. And I was open-minded to it as a busy cook and someone like my mother who was a scratch cook. I mean, those were some of her best secrets were those cake mix cakes. But yes, when I went on book tour, it was tough in some cities, but that was 20 years ago. And some food writers really looked down their nose at me because it was almost as if I was trying to sort of ruin American baking and, you know, take it down some notches. And really all I was trying to do was connect with busy cooks and busy bakers who just wanted to bake and wanted to kind of figure out a way to allow baking into their busy life.
Yeah. It actually kind of gets to the purpose of a cake mix, which is to be able to speed things along. But I mean, they actually have a really interesting history too, right? Like sort of culturally in society.
Yeah, they do. And they, you know, they came onto our shelves after World War II, and they were a way for, you know, for the woman to not feel like she had to be all day in the kitchen and that she could have some leisure time. But what they found with those first cake mixes was that the more the cook added to the mix, cracked the eggs, you know, added their own vanilla, mm-hmm. the more they baked with them. Hmm. It was as if, you know, there had to kind of be this partnership between the cook and the mix. Yeah, it is interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So there was like a psychological hurdle that they had to sort of, because I'm sure they could have like added powdered eggs, or, you know, whatever.
They did in the beginning. They did add powdered egg. And once, you know, the cook added fresh eggs, sales went up. And I think people like, you know, like my mother, who was a creative cook, saw cake mixes not really as liberation as much as it was kind of fun. I mean, they could, you know, she didn't have to measure flour, but she could just dump a cake mix into the bowl and then get creative and have fun with it.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so, you know, let's fast forward. You started experimenting. You wrote this incredibly popular book, Cake Mix Doctor, and now 20 years after that, you have a new book. But I want to start with the mix itself. Like, before we get mm-hmm. into all the things you do with cake mix, and you have like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different things to do with them, does it matter what kind of cake mix you start with?
Yes and no. I would used to say no because I thought cake mixes were pretty similar. Mm-hmm. Today, they're very different. You know, from the very basic, you know, you've got gluten-free cake mixes and then you've got kind of the house brand of cake mix from the supermarket, not so great. But, you know, kind of right there in the middle, you've got your Betty Crocker, your Duncan Hines, your Pillsbury. I can tell the difference between the three of those. You know, someone else may not be able to tell the difference. A lot of people, you know, were raised mm-hmm. on a certain kind of cake mix, a certain brand. So I think it's probably best just to sort of try a couple of different products, maybe some natural ones, maybe a gluten-free, and see what you like, and then go from there.
Yeah. Are there, like, when you say see what you like, how do they differ in flavor and texture and lift? Like, do you see general trends in how they differ?
Yes, cake mixes can differ, I think, in flavor and also texture.
Okay.
So, for example, I think Pillsbury cake mix, and I know it's favored, you know, with Christina Tosi. I think she really likes that cake mix flavor. Mm-hmm. I really don't like that cake mix flavor. It has a lot of yellow food coloring in it. So to me, I'm not going to use that as much as I might use, say, a Betty Crocker that I think has less food coloring. So it might be personal.
Yeah.
As to what mix you choose. Because to me, you know, Francis, to a lot of people, the flavor of cake mix is nostalgic. I mean, they were raised on a cake mix cake. So they think that, you know, the flavor of artificial vanilla is really kind of warm and fuzzy and nostalgic. Yeah. Because, you know, and in my kids' generation, I mean, they were raised, you know, on going to other people's houses and getting like confetti cake, you know, right out of the box, you know. You know, but no, yeah. We had to have a scratch yellow cake or a darn good chocolate cake or something, you know, made with a chocolate cake mix and then like sour cream and pudding and tons of chocolate chips and things like that. I think it's really all your frame of reference. And you can make beautiful rum cakes. A lot of people have really wonderful, you know, memories of growing up with a rum cake made with a box cake mix. So it kind of depends on what your memories are and what your tastes are today. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you mentioned Christina Tosi, and she's, you know, a terrific pastry chef. She Milk Bar is her company, and like she's built this whole empire based on nostalgia from her youth, and she's, I don't know how old she is exactly, but she, you know, she and I are of the same generation anyway, so we kind of grew up with, you know, with those cake mixes and stuff, and she was kind of like one of the first high-end pastry chefs to say, hey, like, those flavors that I grew up with when I was a kid are, I mean, they may be artificial vanilla, but they mean something to me now, and so, you know, she'll make birthday cake cookies and birthday cake ice cream, and she has birthday cake, you know, like the flavor of like kids' birthday cake from like the 80s.
Yes.
You know, she's like turned into a whole thing.
And I admire somebody like, you know, who can do that because, you know, I think in the world that I was in 20 years ago, going on book tours, the Cake Mix Doctor, I mean, you had to be pretty brave to do something like that. But she's got her platform. I think it's awesome that she can say that. And you know, the other thing about that, Frances, is that, like, not everybody can bake a cake from scratch. You don't, either they don't have the know-how, they don't have the ingredients, they've never been taught. So to alienate people and say, you know, you can't bake something because it's not from scratch, really kind of rules out a whole lot of people who rely on the ease of a cake mix, the affordability of a cake mix, and, you know, the fact that they can just throw it together in a matter of minutes.
Yeah, totally. It's funny, I actually read a book last year about Food in Alaska by Julie O'Malley, and I think cupcakes was actually in the title of the book because cake mix is such an important part of Alaskan culture, because, you know, when you're a place where it's really hard to get fresh food, hey, having something that's you know, is shelf stable, and, you know, it just makes it available.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so let's get to some of your favorite secretly simple recipes from your new book. I mean, obviously the whole point of the book, it's called A New Take on Cake, and you're taking cake mix and you're fashioning it, you know, into hundreds of different ways. But what are some of your favorites?
Wow, I have so many. I think I picked up more than a dozen. You know, two of my favorites that really are secretly simple are Susan's Lemon Cake, which is a bundt, my sister's recipe, and the Chocolate Nutella Loaf. Those were the, like, runner-ups, if I had to think of the most secretly simple. Susan's Lemon Cake has been written about a lot. I know it's Jamie Lee Curtis's favorite recipe. She makes it once a week.
I love it.
I know. And so, you know, I kind of have to give that a shout out. But
tell us about it. Tell us about that cake.
Well, it is just a yellow, Frances, it is just a yellow cake mix, but the secret ingredient is yellow jello. It even rhymes. Yeah, seriously. Lemon yellow jello, I should say. And eggs and oil, and that's really about it. And you bake it in, you know, a bundt pan, and you can make a glaze or not. But it is so moist, it's so simple. I mean, it's just easy. And that recipe, by the way, is a Cake Mix Doctor favorite. And so, yes, I did update it for this new book. Mm-hmm. The other recipe, though, is a chocolate Nutella loaf, and I think that speaks to the way that I know I'm baking today and a lot of people are baking today, even if it starts with a mix, because this recipe just has a chocolate cake mix, a cup of Nutella, some oil, eggs, and coconut milk, and that's it. And if you want to fold in, you know, some chocolate chips, you can do it. It goes into a loaf pan, it bakes, and you don't even need to frost it. And I think that this cake kind of says where we are in easy baking today. It's just stripped down, it's simple. And the use of, I think, a pantry staple like coconut milk in baking, even if you start with a mix, is just one of the just revelations I made with this book, because it's so much nicer than whole milk from the fridge. Yeah, it made really moist, rich cakes. And
do you
then
taste
Nutella,
the coconut, or is it?
No, you really don't. But it's funny how I do tend to pair it with flavors like chocolate and coconut and banana, some things that I think could benefit if you could taste the coconut. But I think with all that going on, you've got with the chocolate mix and the Nutella, you really can't taste it. And Nutella is such a crazy ingredient to bake with, because you do taste the chocolate and the hazelnuts when, you know, when you cut and slice into that cake. But everything I've made with Nutella, it's just wild how it just turns out such great cupcakes and whatever. I mean, I don't understand fully, you know, how Nutella is made. Maybe you do. But it's amazing in baking. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, it's got so much of the pureed hazelnut, but also, I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of fat in there, but delicious fat.
There's got to be fat and some sugar too.
It probably stabilizes everything and keeps everything moist. And, you know, this is the kind of baking that I can certainly pull off, because I am not proud of my skills as a baker, but this I can definitely pull off and I would love to try. It was great to talk with you, Anne.
Oh, thank you so much, Frances.
Anne Byrne is the author of A New Take on Cake. You can find her recipe for chocolate Nutella loaf at splendidtable.org. Coming up, pastry chef Paola Velez. Panna cotta, everyone. I'm Frances Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. All Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. You know, it is always such a thrill to come across someone who you know is going to be a star while at the rise of their career, and Paula Velez is absolutely one of those people. She's a lauded pastry chef already. She was named a Best New Chef by Food & Wine this year. She's the host of a totally delightful video series called Pastries with Paula. And oh yeah, in her spare time, she's the co-founder of Bakers Against Racism, which has held $2 million worth of bake sales for social justice organizations. And for all of her passion for baking, we're going to talk about something that doesn't even go into your oven today. Hey, Chef.
Hi, Francis. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. And especially because we get to talk about dessert. But we were talking the other day and you said you have a secretly simple dessert of choice. So what is that?
It's deceptively simple.
Deceptively simple.
You might think that this is one of the most fancy soigné desserts on planet Earth, but the panna cotta is my favorite and easiest dessert to make. And I think everybody that's at home should be making it too.
Okay. I love panna cotta. And just basically defined, right? It's just basically a custard that is made very simply with like gelatin to help set cream. It just means cooked cream, right? It's sugar, cream, often vanilla and gelatin, and that's kind of it. But I want to talk to you about why it's deceptively simple, because I think those are all the ingredients. I just mentioned them. I may have missed something, but I think that's pretty much it. But I also find that like panna cotta is something that, I don't know, I feel like chefs get really snooty about. Maybe it's because it is so simple that they all be like, well, no, it has to be perfect. And they start getting all whatever about, you know, whether it's like too jiggly or not jiggly enough or too soft. So what's your take on that? Are we just overthinking it?
I think so. I think a lot of the industry, I mean, look, I'm pretty honest. And I think a lot of the industry is fighting for that prime time, like, airway, right? They want to be written about. They want to be known for their ingenuity and their craft and how they can manipulate ingredients. But sometimes we get so lost in the sauce that we just forget to make something simple and beautiful and elegant. And I think some of us, when we dine out, we don't want to, I don't know, have fireworks coming out of a dessert. We just want to have something that's going to be like the end of your meal. Sometimes you're with friends, sometimes you're with family, and you don't want the meal to end, but a panna cotta is like a soothing way to end a beautiful night out with family and friends.
I love that. Okay, so what's a good panna cotta to you? Like, describe a good panna cotta.
I think it's like finding the balance between ingredients, right? Yeah, you can do a vanilla panna cotta or cinnamon panna cotta. and flavor it with outside ingredients, you know, fruits, whatever it is that you want to put on there, chocolate crispy pearls, etc. But I think finding ingredients that mesh well with the cream and bind so that it makes this smooth, cohesive texture is like my favorite thing to do. I was partnering with a lot of Amish farms a couple of years ago, and they would grow something, they would bring it, and they'd be like, are you interested in this? And I'm like, absolutely. You came all this way with this, so I'm going to use it. And I found Blue Hubbard squash, right? When people think about like pumpkin spice season, which we spoke about earlier, which I think, you know, if you want to drink PSLs, drink them, be merry, because we're no literally judgment. Going through a global pandemic. And if you find joy in anything right now, go for it, you know?
Right on.
But the Blue Hubbard squash, it's not very fibrous. And when you cook it, I roasted it in some brown sugar, a little bit of butter, and I cooked it down until it was like tender, fork tender. And when I cooked it with the cream, it melted into the cream. And that flavor of the Blue Hubbard with a little bit of warming spices felt like a warm hug to me. And everybody that ate at the restaurant, they thought the same thing. And I think that you could do so much with just pure ingredients like panna cotta, with other pure ingredients to make something that is exciting and exhilarating and so simple to make.
Oh, I love that. Okay, so you kind of described the process already, but in this case, you use a Blue Hubbard squash, which like we use like a butternut squash or like other kinds of
squashes
like that.
That's like the beauty of baking, right? A lot of people think that it's like a science, but it's really like an applied science. You have to really try what you like. And I think with baking, it's not like chicken. Chicken, you have to cook to a certain temperature so that it's not raw, right? No, seriously, right? Like, you have to cook it to a certain temperature so it's not raw. So that kind of, like, application's always, like, dead set. But with pastry, right, like, maybe you're making a brownie and you want your center to be molten. Maybe you want it to be hard and crispy, like, on the edges. Maybe you want it that perfect medium in between where it's just slightly... Well, I don't like using the word moist, but slightly moist, but still like dense enough to give you like a bite, right? Same thing goes with all baking and pastry. It's up to you and your preference and what you're going to make into your family's recipes that you're going to hand down from generations to generations.
I love that. You are literally the first person who's ever said this. Like, baking is not a science. It's not like cooking. Like, I've literally never heard anyone say that before, because like you said, like, that's always a cliche, like, oh, baking is the science and cooking you can freewheel. But it's like, no, you're right. If you freewheel too much with the chicken, you have like raw chicken, and that's no bueno. But like a little bit of like an undercooked brownie center, no one's mad. Okay, but let's get back to this. So you're talking about roasting the squash with some butter and brown sugar, and then pureeing it, and then basically just adding that to the cream, and then adding the gelatin to that to set it.
Yes.
Like, walk us through the whole process.
Of course. So you're going to take your Blue Hubbard squash or whatever squash of your choice that can be roasted and pureed down into a smooth puree, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, don't do this with spaghetti squash, right? But you're going to take that and you're going to cook it with whatever spices, whether it's cardamom, black pepper, cinnamon, nutmeg, mace, whatever you want. And you're going to then make it fork tender, right? I like to give it a little char too, right? Because it gives it depth of flavor. So sometimes when you're experimenting with different flavors, you want to add different umami notes, right? And that's what kind of like sets your dessert apart from somebody else's dessert. So I let my edges really crisp up to almost get that burnt smoky flavor. Then I'm going to puree it down, add it to my cream. I'm going to make sure that I'm sweetening my cream with whatever sweeteners I want to use. So let's say I'm using coconut sugar. I'm going to make sure that the sugar dissolves, but I'm not going to boil my cream. You want to bring it up to a scald. And this is where the kind of process differs. Some people bring it up to a boil because they're just used to boiling cream. But I think that a lot of the moisture disappears when you bring it up to a boil. So I bring it up to a scald just enough so that it's almost like a little bit more than a warm bath, right?
Okay.
And then I'm going to make sure that there's no more sugar crystals on the bottom. It tastes yummy. I'm going to add my gelatin. and I'm going to let that gelatin fully dissolve. And then I'm going to wait a little bit. I'm not going to pipe it into my mold right away. I'm not going to pour it into whatever vessel I'm pouring it into because it might be too hot, right? And that will bring condensation. So I take it, I let it cool, just chill out a little bit, but still not cold because you don't want the gelatin to set. And then you're going to pour it into your vessel. And then you're going to think about
cups or ramekins or bowls or whatever.
When you're at home, I almost suggest doing it in a mason jar because then you can cover it up and then you have a dessert ready to go on the ready.
I love that.
But then what I do after that is I let my panna cotta set because usually you need at least 4 hours for your panna cotta to set. And now is when you're going to build other components. So I'm going to take some honey. I'm going to take more of that Blue Hubbard squash and I'm going to roast it together and make sure that it has some bite to it. Not super soft, right? Now we're going for texture. And I'm going to get pumpkin seeds. I'm going to toast them with a little bit of butter and warm spices and salt. And that's my crunch factor, right? And then if I really want to get fancy with it, I'm going to go to the farmer's market. I'm going to find some edible blossoms of the season. Right now, tangerine lace and marigolds are doing their bounty. So I'm going to buy some marigolds. And I think that the marigolds gives it like an herbaceous flavor that complements the Blue Hubbard. But if you're at home, you can make this. Put some honey and pumpkin spice seasoning. And that you have a simple, beautiful, elegant dessert. You don't have to be crazy like me.
No one said you're crazy. No one said you're crazy.
Just a little
bit. You know, you're
just
exuberant. Thanks so much, Chef. It was so fun to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Paula Velez is the co-founder of Bakers Against Racism, is a food and wine best new chef, and has a super fun video series on the old internet called Pastries with Paula. And if she's inspired you, you can find a whole collection of panna cotta recipes at splendidtable.org. Aran Goyoaga is the creator of Canelle Edvini, one of the most beloved gluten-free cookbook authors and bloggers. And her food comes from a whole bunch of different influences, but among them is the fact that she grew up in the Basque country of Spain, and the fact that her grandparents owned a pastry shop. She's here to tell us about one of the recipes from her new book, Canelle Edvini Bakes Simple. Hey, Aran, so great to talk with you.
Hi, Francis. Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited because I want to talk with you about one of your simple cookies. It is the orange flower water and almond crinkles. Honestly, because it's not every day that I... you know, read a recipe title and say yes to every single word in the recipe title. Like, I love orange flower water. I love almond. Crinkle sounds great. Let's do this. So before we get into the story of this cookie, tell me what I should expect when I bite into one of these because I'm going to make them.
So they are actually a cookie that, in my opinion, are better days after. They become a little bit crispy on the exterior and they're very chewy inside and they stay chewy for a while and they last a long time. So they're one of those cookies that you can have in a jar, sort of like biscotti can be, you know, but these are moist. They're not crispy all through. So they're like a, it's like a tea cookie, but it's very chewy. And, you know, it's only almond flour, so there's no other fat except for a little bit of egg. So it's really the moisture comes from the almonds and the fat comes from the almonds.
Oh, cool. So it's like rich and nutty and a little bit of the orange flower water. I think that's such a beautiful flavor. It's, you know, for folks who haven't had it, it kind of tastes like orange, but not really. It's sort of like it's almost... It's orangey, but it doesn't. I don't taste it and think, oh my god, oranges. It just tastes like floral and beautiful.
Exactly. It's just to me, it's very floral, like not citrusy at all. And in fact, I think I was actually reading about orange flower water that it's an anti-anxiety kind of extract. The oil
really
is used for anti-anxiety. So I thought that was really kind of interesting. I didn't use it for that reason, but. I mean, this cookie I haven't really invented. it's kind of comes from hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, you wrote about that in the headnote, that you have, you name all these different influences of cookies of your past that have sort of inspired this one. Tell me about some of those cookies. What did you take from each?
So for me, it starts in my grandparents' bakery, Macarrones. Mm. They're very, very typical Spanish cookie. They're made with almond flour, sugar, and in this case, they're made with egg whites. And in my recipe, it has a whole egg. Mm-hmm. But they're very popular. They're popular in the Basque Country, in southwestern France, where I also tasted the macarons, which are different than the macarons from Paris. But I think when I started digging deeper into this, the origin really comes from Morocco and sort of the Moorish Empire that was settled in the Iberian Peninsula for hundreds of years. And in fact, a few years ago, I did a little project that was a documentary for the Spanish National Library, where we were kind of digging into old cookbooks. And I had to make a recipe for macarrones de almendra, which is came from from a book from 1755. And super simple. Again, and I think the influence really is Moorish. In Arabic, certainly with the orange flour water. I loved the thread of these, like this simple cookie that was made hundreds of years ago.
We'll be back with more from Aran Goyoaga, author of Canel et Vinny Bake Simple, in a minute. And then Chef Dave Barron with another Basque recipe that is definitely not hundreds of years old. Stick around. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking about secretly simple dessert ideas this week, and we're mid-chat with Aran Goyoaga about her orange flour water and almond crinkle cookies. Let's get back to her. Okay, so let's get into making them. As you say, the recipe is super simple. I think I read in the recipe that, you know, when you've seen people make these, they don't even necessarily need a mixing bowl. They can kind of mix the dough right on the cutting board. But there are a couple of techniques that are really interesting. One is after you've mixed the almond flour, sugar, egg, and the orange flour water, you ball them up into little balls and then you roll them in powdered sugar. What does that do?
So that creates like a little crust of sugar that is going to get caramelized and crystallized in the oven. And that's going to become a little bit crispy and is going to also keep the moisture in after baked.
Oh, cool. What
gives it a little bit of that thin, crispy crust, which initially after baking, it doesn't come through as much when they sit for a while. That's why I think this cookie is better a couple days later.
Interesting.
And you could even use granulated sugar, but I love powdered sugar, like the effect of it. It really appears more like a crinkle, like a crackly cookie. It's just so visually stunning. And it's so simple to make. And kind of my biggest memory of my family's pastry shop making cookies, it was never in a bowl. Like all the cookies were shortbreads or kind of like the forçage technique where you drag, you know, the ingredients together on a...
Sort of smear them together with your hands. Yeah.
In the palm of your hand, just kind of pushing it. And this is kind of how I remember my grandfather making macarrones, or these... I don't call them macarons in the book, but they're essentially macarrones. I mix them by hand until I feel the dough. It's kind of like a very sticky cookie dough. Almost initially, it might seem a little bit thin, almost like a thick cake batter. And then you let it sit for 10 minutes, and as everything hydrates, it kind of stiffens a little bit. And then with damp hands, you roll them into balls, roll them in the sugar, and then you have a preheated oven. So you have your oven preheated to the maximum temperature that it can go.
Yeah, this was the other technique I thought was so interesting, because you don't have an oven temperature. You know, I've never seen a cookie or any baking recipe where it doesn't say preheat oven to this temperature. You just say blast your oven on high while you make the dough, and then like whatever temperature it is by the time you're done making the dough is good.
Yeah, you turn the oven off when you put the sheet pan in, and then you let them bake for about 10, 12 minutes. It really sometimes depends on your oven, but it reminds me a lot of actually meringues. You know how with meringues to get that kind of crispy exterior and then mm-hmm. more of a chewy, soft interior, you have to, you can begin with a high temperature and then turn it off or keep it at a very low temperature. So it's almost like a very gentle baking at the end.
Yeah. So it just hits it with heat and then it just kind of cools out and it sort of cooks through.
Yeah.
But it just works. I'm just so mesmerized by the...
I mean, I think you always, in baking, you always have to experiment.
Okay.
But I do feel like this cookie is very forgiving. And I like to put my rack kind of on the bottom just to be safe. If it's the first time I'm baking these, you know, mm-hmm. you might want to be careful when you put the sheet pan in and then you turn it off. If you leave, I don't know, 30 seconds, it might be too hot. So I would say be safe and kind of start in your lower rack.
Okay.
And I mean, I've never had an issue with this recipe in different ovens. So I feel like it's really forgiving. The whole thing is just... It just reminds me how baking has, you know, it's an ancient tradition with the simplest ingredients. And I was thinking about powdered sugar too. Like all the newer recipes that I've seen use powdered sugar. And I was thinking, but how did they have powdered sugar back, you know, in the 8th century? Or, you know, were they pulverizing sugar to really fine texture? So I was thinking about all these
some,
things.
Some poor servants in there just like rolling a rock over the sugar or whatever.
Yeah. This is definitely like a Moroccan griba. And so it really is a technique that I see throughout, you know, kinds of different recipes that I reference.
Yeah. So I mean, like I said, I love orange flower water, but have you made this with other flavors? You know, is there another way that you might flavor this?
Yeah, well, you can do it if you don't like, because I feel like a lot of people are a little bit sensitive to orange flower water or anything that is sure. very floral. And you could simply flavor it with orange zest. There is some orange zest written in the recipe, but you mm-hmm. could just add a little bit more lemon. You can even do a little bit of cocoa powder. And they're really beautiful, too, like the contrast of the powdered sugar and the cocoa. You add a tiny bit of cocoa powder until you get the color that you want. And maybe you need to add a tiny bit more egg. Mm-hmm. And then you roll them in powdered sugar. And then just the contrast of the white.
Oh, the dark cookie mm-hmm, with the white exactly. crinkle. Yeah.
And you could put a little bit of coffee in it, too. Like a finely ground espresso. I feel like it's a really versatile. Anything that goes well with almond. Even cardamom. Yeah, now I'm thinking you could do
cardamom
a
sounds
touch
so
of
good.
Orange zest and, you know, a couple of cardamom little seeds crushed up. That would be really good. And vanilla.
So awesome.
I mean, we're just going. Anything, really.
I mean, yeah, actually, if you think, I mean, almonds are a beautiful flavor, but they can be so neutral. So it can go with so many things. Let me ask you about the coffee. You mentioned you can put like espresso powder in it. Would you do maybe to keep the moisture ratio? I don't know if it's this sensitive, but like, would you maybe do swap in the same amount of brewed espresso as you would orange flower water just to keep the same liquid?
You could, but I think it would need, it's a very small amount of orange flower water. It's like a teaspoon. Okay. So you kind of would need a little bit more of a
flavor.
Potent. Yeah. I think you could add the brewed espresso for sure for moisture and sort of to get that same consistency. But I think you would need to finally grind some coffee and then just add for boost.
Okay.
I haven't experimented with that, but now it makes me want to try it.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Anand. I can't wait to bake these.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope you do try them.
Aran Goyoaga's new book is Canelle Evigny Bake Simple, a new way to bake gluten-free. You can find her recipe for orange flower water and almond crinkles at splendidtable.org. Dave Barron made his name as a chef while running the kitchen at Grant Achatz's avant-garde Alinea, one of the greatest restaurants in the world, where he was inventing, like, magic tricks with food. But it was while he was running Alinea's sister restaurant next where he started working on what would end up being one of his signature dishes, an incredible burnt cheesecake that seems like it would be nearly impossible to make. Dave Barron, it's great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you, too. It's been a while.
It's been a little minute. And, you know, I am still thinking about our cheesecake, the cheesecake that I had when I last saw you.
Oh, yes.
All right. So I want to talk to you about it. It's really become kind of a signature cheesecake. If one can say, hello, I have a signature cheesecake, you're probably that person.
You know, it's funny, too, because we have this, you know, as you call it, the signature cheesecake, but it's never been a menu item. It's never been something that you can, well, aside from like, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks when we were doing outdoor brunch at Pajoli, it's never been on a menu available to order. Yet somehow everyone knows about it. Everyone wants it. So,
Okay, let's talk about the signature cheesecake. Because you, the other thing that's important to note is you were the first to admit that you didn't invent it.
Yeah, no, not mine.
Tell us about this cheesecake that you were so famous for that you did not invent.
I wish I'd have invented it, but I didn't. I did everything in my power that I could to copy it. Exactly. Back in, I think it was like 2014, I was with my old boss, Grant Ackett's, and we were doing research for the tapas menu for Next. And we did like a tour of Barcelona, and we had Albert Adria showing us around. And then we went to San Sebastian, and we had Arzak and Andoni from Mugar Eats, and they were giving us a whole like Pinchos tour in Old Town. And, you know, as like the typical Americans, we kind of look at them at the end of this like gluttonous food crawl across town, you know, like 4 hours in, we're like, what do you eat for dessert? And Arzak laughs and Andoni goes, no desserts, and does like the finger wave at us in his like, you know, very broken English. And then he goes, maybe one. And he walks us to like the very back corner of Old Town. And just next to the church, there's this little place called Lavinia. And we walk in and he starts like, you know, it's a crowd. It's a mess in there. And he starts like holding up his hand and, you know, pointing numbers at the person. All of a sudden these plates come out with like this sloppy disaster on them. And it's like burnt. It kind of looks like brie cheese. It's oozing out. It's like some of them are on their side. Some of them aren't. Some of them look like someone stepped on them. And, you know, typical like ego-y chef. Ackett's and I look at it and we're like, are you kidding me? And we're kind of laughing at it. We take our first bite and we're like, not to sound cliche, but it was like that moment where, you know, it like, it's like Ratatouille moment kind of thing. It didn't take me somewhere to my childhood, but it took me somewhere I'd never been. And we had this bite of this cheesecake and it's like all time stopped around us. And we're like, what did we just have? And so for the next, I think 4 days that we were there, we went at least twice a day to get a slice. And, you know, most of the time we were able to get one. Sometimes we weren't, you know, because they sell out. They open in the morning and when they're sold out, they close. So.
And the idea is it's a cheesecake, only it looks totally burnt and it doesn't look cooked because it's oozy and
so like the cheesecake as we know it is like this like beautiful little French thing, even like a New York style, still cooked like the water bath and slow and low and don't let it get too hot and don't let air bubbles and no color on it. And this cheesecake is no crust and it is just burnt. It is raw in the middle. And the whole structure of it comes from the overcooking on the outside holding the middle in it. It goes against like everything you would do with a cheesecake, you know.
Yeah. To be honest, when I first got a slice of this cake from you, I was like, huh, okay. So it is totally burnt to a crisp, like charred. And then, you know, it was like really smushy. It wasn't like raw and runny, I remember. It was still like kind of cheesecakey. But then when I ate it, I was like, okay, this is so smooth, so creamy. But that like burnt edge was like so bitter and almost like flakes off because it's so burnt. And I just remember thinking like, oh, this is like, you know, if someone like left their cheesecake out by a campfire for a little while and like it's some of that flavor kind of got into it. It was almost like a burnt marshmallow flavor, but cheesy and creamy. So it was just, it was incredible. I mean, I understood why you became obsessed.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, my impression once I got past the sort of jarring aspect was the same. Like everything about it is fixing the challenges of the problems that it has. Yeah. You know, the creaminess is too creamy, but the burnt brings it back and makes it savory. But then, you know, it's a beautiful accident.
Yeah. And then how did you learn to make it? Did you ask them for the recipe? Did you?
No, I wanted to, but again, my Spanish is not quite as great as I would hope. we had a good relationship with the team at Mugar Eats. And so I'd asked, Jade, who was their R&D chef. And I think another chef named Daniel. I was like, can you find this out? Find out what kind of cheese they're using. Find out this. And they kept coming back to me and they're like, we don't speak Basque. Like, we can't quite decipher what they're saying. Phonetically, it looks and sounds like this, but we're not sure. And they really had nothing for me. And so Mike Bagel, who was the chef de cuisine of Alinea at the time, he and I basically, like, competed to see who could figure it out first. And so every day for 3 months, we were just making cheesecakes. I say every day, but it was like there was some form of R&D done pretty much every day for 3 months on how to figure this out. And the problem was we were approaching it from this mindset of how a proper chef would create something like this. And so you're like, well, the structure's firm on the outside and the inside's this, and maybe they're tempering that. And I think they whip this component to add this component. And, you know, everything was like so over-chefed. And eventually it just became this, you know, we started just removing components and looking at it and saying, okay, let's start at the beginning. There's like three people in that kitchen. The kitchen hasn't been updated ever from what we could see. And there's like one oven. So they're not whipping egg whites and tempering in yolks. They're baking like 30 cheesecakes in a day with two people and one giant stand mixer and, as far as we were concerned, a pizza oven. And so we just started trying to simplify over and over and over again. And eventually, I was baking one day and I was like, screw it. I'm just going to mix these five ingredients together. I'm going to bake them as hot as I can. And then when it's burnt, I'm going to take it out of the oven and see what happens. And that was it. That was it. I mean, there were other aspects to it. Like we were trying to figure out the cheese and, you know, we thought it'd be some like special sheep's milk, Basque, whatever kind of like, you know, coveted thing. And
yeah, famous for their sheep. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you start looking at like cheesecake and what would they use and what makes the most sense. I'm like, they're just using cream cheese. Like they have to. And phonetically, the way that they were spelling it, I didn't talk to anyone at Lavinia, so I don't actually know. But the way I was looking, I was like, it looks like it reads Philadelphia. So we're just like, screw it. Let's just do Philadelphia cream cheese. So I just went for it. I literally like you start looking at it from the chef's perspective and you're like, well, if the inside's raw, but it's not grainy, then there can't be flour in it because it never gets hot enough for the flour to actually cook. So it's going to be sandy, but theirs wasn't sandy. So we took flour out of the recipe and I'm like, well, you had the flour to absorb the egg whites, but if there's no flour in it, then it's too soupy. So we should take out the egg whites. And you just kept taking things out. And all I was left with was cream cheese, egg yolk. You know, in our case, we used creme fraiche because I wanted a little tangier, but the original version that we tried was like cream, sugar and salt. That's it.
And then, so walk us through cooking it because I have seen all kinds of videos of like burnt Basque cheesecake. Now that's like a thing.
Sure.
And like there's some like Michelin star chef who has some like some flamboyant version where he takes it out of the oven and hits it with a blowtorch.
Oh, yeah.
Your method is simpler than that.
I mean, and frankly, like I tried all of those things. And the only thing we kept coming back to is if we want it to be as authentic as we can make it, we have to think like we're working in their kitchen and we're one person making 40 a day. And one person making 40 a day isn't going to delicately blowtorch each one. They're going to figure out a system where it just goes in and out of the oven and they're done.
And so you just mix it up?
Yeah, so we use a Roboku, just like a food processor. The only trick that we have is that you have to temper the cream cheese.
Okay. Just taking it out of the fridge and let it sit on your counter until it's like room temperature. That's what you mean.
That's it. You just let it sit. You add the yolks and the sugar and the salt to that. You process it into a paste. You can do it in a mixer too with a paddle, but you cream it all.
Yeah.
And then you add the creme fraiche. You do that just until it's incorporated and take it out so it doesn't whip, because if it whips, the whole thing curdles when you bake it. And then you just pour it into a paper-lined springform pan, and you bake it at like 475 for 23 minutes. That's it.
23 minutes.
Yeah. Well, in our oven. So when we were at Dialogue, it was 23 minutes, but you have to rotate it at 12 minutes if you're baking three at a time in the oven. And then when I went to Pajoli and tried to do the exact same thing, it didn't come out right. But they use a combi oven, and it's like 22 minutes with like you know, the fan on full blast. So
you can't stop chefing it. You're talking about the simplest recipe in the world, and you can't stop chefing it.
Just get your oven as hot as you can. And the whole trick is you pull it out and it should be burnt, and then you jiggle it. And if it looks like a little mini tidal wave, or like, I mean, I guess I'm dating myself because I'm old. Do you know what like a waterbed looks like when you push on it and it doesn't have enough water in it? No one has waterbeds anymore. So maybe that's a, you know, anyone who's like over 40 is going to know what one looks like, I guess. But yeah, it gets a little tidal wave to it. And then you take it out, you let it cool in the fridge overnight, and it's ready.
Beautiful.
So like the entire process should be 5 minutes and then 20 minutes to bake.
I love it. I love it. All right, I'm going to come see you again.
Please.
And you're going to give me another slice of these things.
You can have a whole one.
All right, Chef. It was great to talk with you.
All right, good to talk to you too.
Dave Barron is the chef owner of Pajoli in Santa Monica. You can find that recipe for Basque cheesecake at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for this week. And look, I was just joking about ticking off my doctor. Doctors are amazing. Please thank your doctor today for existing. But yeah, have a little dessert. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.